Dharma talk. The theme today is truth and fear. 2,600 years ago, in India, a young man called Gautama sat under a peepal tree, not far from where I have the privilege of teaching in India each year, in Bodh Gaya. This young man, of course, we now refer to as the Buddha, the awakened one. And he had some extraordinary experiences. Can't hear? I'm sorry? The speaker's not on?
Yeah.
Thank you. Can everybody hear now? If you can't, you wouldn't know. Okay, so now we have the technology in place. The theme is truth and fear. So the Buddha had some extraordinary awakening experiences. And in one of the texts, there's a recording of what he says about it. And I thought you might be rather interested in what that is. He says, "I discovered that profound truth, so difficult to perceive, difficult to understand, tranquilizing and sublime, which is not to be gained by mere reasoning and is visible only to the wise." So the discovery of truth, the knowing of the touch of truth, the truth that liberates and frees, cannot be reached by reasoning through the mind, through the analytical sense of mind. But rather we are asked to bring our entire heart and mind to the inquiry. In another sutta in the Middle Length Discourses, the Buddha says there are two kinds of search. The search that's subject to birth, aging, pain and death, and the search for awakening or enlightenment, which is not subject to birth and death. And so this, of course, is what we're interested in, to discover that which is not subject to birth and death, that which is not bound in or up in birth and death. And it's a deep and profound inquiry. And as the Buddha said, it's not easy to understand. He describes this as the unborn supreme security. He says, Nirvana, the unaging, the deathless, the sorrowless, the undefiled supreme security. So what actually happened, I wonder? So what is this tranquilizing, sublime liberation that he's talking about? So for those not so familiar with the Dharma teachings, the truths of the noble ones are that in this life there is suffering, the causes of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path that leads to the cessation or the end of suffering. And of course, our suffering is to be comprehended or understood. The causes of suffering are to be abandoned. Liberation is to be realized and the path to be cultivated. So they're the actions that go with each of the noble truths. So what is it to awaken, to wake up? In another sutta he says this, that when he sat under the tree, vision arose, understanding arose, wisdom arose, knowing arose, light arose. So this series of five words is used with regard to each of the four noble truths. And the combination of those words of vision, understanding, wisdom, knowing, and light help us get a little sense or feeling of the inspirational quality or the inspirational insight that occurred as the Buddha sat under the tree. So through our practice, through the practice of mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, we too walk the path that's not subject to birth, aging, pain and death. In our practice, we are asked to reach to the depth of our own direct knowing, the knowing that illuminates and frees. It's a knowing that emerges when we intuit the sublime, when we bring our heart and mind to the ordinary events of life, and we're touched by the extraordinary nature of things that occur. For example, I was sitting in Tel Aviv the other night with a friend, and we were sitting on the beach in the sand, watching the waves, the ocean, feeling the warm air on my face. And just the touch of the air, the incredible beauty and simplicity of that, was expansive, exquisite, beautiful. And in that, there's no problem anywhere. So sometimes the ordinary is perceived as extraordinary. And also the other way around. We realize the extraordinary nature of very ordinary things. So we're invited to bring our unreactive awareness to every situation that we face in this life, and trust our capacity to just be with whatever occurs with our unreactive awareness. And if we can do that, there's a sense that life unfolds incredibly freely when we get out of our own way. Life unfolds freely already. And when we can just do that, we discover the authenticity of practice. Sometimes life doesn't feel very tranquil or sublime. We experience great turmoil in the feeling world, and life seems to be fraught with anxieties and fears, or doubts, or we develop some quite destructive patterns of behavior or reactivity that's based on our memories from the past. So sometimes we might feel overwhelmed or trapped and quite powerless as our rage and despair manifests. Or some of us might feel lonely or insecure. However, these moments too are an opportunity to bring our unreactive awareness to all of that. And in that simple acknowledgement, there's a recognition and release that can occur. So we need to, if we can, bring a fresh response, a fresh approach to everything we encounter. And to have a willingness to explore, to inquire. And then there's a wonderful depth of healing that can be noticed, that can take place. Then we, when that occurs, we awaken to a fresh way of seeing that isn't bound to the division of self and other. So when the division of self and other ceases, we recognize the indivisible reality. The differenceless nature of things. And there's also another sutta about that. And it's quite short. The Buddha says, whatever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after, and pondered over by the mind, all that do I know. Whatever is seen, pondered over by the mind, all that I fully understood. All that is known to the Tathagata, the Buddha, that means. But the Buddha has not taken his stand upon it. And this is critical and crucial. So the information comes through the sense doors, there's contact. Things are seen, we think, we can know things and fully understand them, we can reflect on things, but not take a stand upon it. So in other words, not to see from a standpoint of self, not to see through the veil of a fixed view, not to be hooked into a particular way of being or seeing. And this sense of self that we have, habitually have, may land in a role. It may land in a cultural identity or a cultural narrative. And I had some experience of this on my way here. On my way here, I had a rather interesting encounter with Israeli security. As many of you probably have had. I was in Bangkok wanting, of course, to catch my El Al flight to Tel Aviv. So I came to the counter and I noticed before the check-in counter there were about 6 or 7 different people. And I rather naively thought, oh, that's incredibly efficient. You know, so many people to help. And then of course, somebody took me aside and said, oh, I just would like to ask you some questions. And a friend had warned me. He'd said, Radha, you'll be really grilled about why you are going to Israel. So I thought, okay. And he seemed incredibly, of course, polite and kind and, you know, friendly. So I said, I just want to ask you some questions. And I was expecting questions like we're asked in Australia. You know, they say, did you pack your own bag? And are there any aerosols in it? And so on. I was expecting questions like that, but no. He said, you know, have you been to Israel before? Is this your first time? And the minute I said it was my first time, he went, why are you going? Have you got family there? And then there was this barrage of questions so fast that I couldn't answer any of them. And of course, that made me feel quite confused. It's like, so many questions. And so eventually I said, no, to meet friends. I'm going to meet friends. Which sounded a bit pathetic, really, didn't it? And he said, what friends? And then he said, do you really know who they are? What are their full names and addresses? And where do they live? And what do they do? And how do you know them? And where did you meet them? And so on. And finally I got a word in and I said, in India. And then I thought, even I wouldn't believe me. This is ridiculous. So here I am, sounding really uncertain and unsure of myself, suddenly. And of course, I did meet people in India, and they invited me here. And that was precisely the truth, but it sounded rather feeble. And so there I was, a bit taken aback by the questioning. And I could kind of feel myself thinking, oh, what will I do next? And then, of course, he said, and what are you doing there? What are you going for? And I said, oh, I'm going for meditation. At which point he thought that was absolutely absurd. And he started to be really disparaging, actually. And obviously he didn't know about this. But he said, no, why are you going there? Why are you going there for meditation and so on? And again, another barrage of questions. So I thought, what to do here? And then I kind of just searched his face with my eyes. And I thought, he looks very Thai. Because I wasn't sure whether he was, you know, Thai or Israeli because of his job. And I thought, he looks very Thai to me in features. And so I took the plunge. I said, I am a Dharma teacher. At which point his face just lit up and he bowed to me. So he was like bowing. So there, of course, his identity, his sense of self, went from I'm the security officer interrogating this person to the cultural identity and the habit of, oh, Dharma teacher, bow. And so it was extraordinary. And so for a moment there was just a lovely meeting between the two of us. And then of course he just went back into the other role, like a flip back. And he said, but someone might use you to put a bomb in your luggage and blow up the plane. At which point I prickled with fear at that suggestion. You know, it was like I could feel the sensations in the body. I thought, oh, watch those sensations, Radha. And they just subsided a little bit. And I thought, well, that's not a very nice thing to say to me just before I get on a plane, because it feeds the thought. So there I was. And so he said, what are you doing there? And again, I said, I'm going to teach the Dharma. And then again, he flipped back the other way. And again, more bows. And it was just the most extraordinary kind of dance of the self moving from one role to another, and back to the other, and so on. And then, of course, I had to reflect on my part in this and what was happening for me. And so, of course, I said to him, I said, oh, you have very good security here. And then I said, well, actually, I'm glad you do, after what he'd said to me about the bomb. And then the next part of it was, he said, I'll give you a security sticker. I said, thank you. And then he said, but don't lose it, you'll be in trouble. Again, the flip into the role. And I felt myself going from, you know, being the traveller, being in the role of Dharma teacher. I ordinarily would not ever have mentioned that I'm a Dharma teacher. I'd say I'm just going to travel as a tourist, because I am. I'm going, but I was just put in that position where I used that identity of Dharma teacher. I hope that was okay. And also, I thought, well, why not? interrogate me. I mean, I feel like I look obviously innocent. But actually, why not me? I mean, who am I to suddenly think that I should not be questioned or I should not be asked those questions? So this is my sense of self landing in, you know, just the very sort of slight edge of, well, you know, do I really look like a terrorist? No, I don't. But that's an assumption on my part too. So the I shifts and lands and rests and does this kind of dance. The sense of I forms and dissolves as we live, as we interact, as we relate. And it can form and dissolve really unproblematically. We're not trying to get rid of the I. It's simply about not clinging to it and not seeing it as me and mine and who I am, and recognizing the fleeting, insubstantial nature of it. It doesn't have a substance. It's shifting, changing, elusive. We can't find it. We can look, we can't see it anywhere. It's constructed with the mind. Well, there was another bit to my story. Then I went to the counter. I finally made it to the counter. And then the person behind the counter said, but you've got a one-way ticket. You've only got a one-way ticket. As if, what am I going to do in Israel? Blow myself up so that I never come back? And he said it three times, each time his voice getting higher and higher and more alarmed. And I said, I'm flying on to London. I have my tickets here if you want to see them. And then he went, oh, okay, no need. So it was just a rather interesting kind of dance. And for my part in it, I suppose I had a little uncertainty about where I was going because I hadn't been here before. And I didn't know it would be so fabulous, but Christopher told me it was. So when we cling to a sense of self, or when we cling to a perceived idea about another, we often assume an assumption of threat or fear. These factors contribute to fear. They're not the truth of the situation, but our perceived ideas can contribute to fear. So we actually don't see the reality of the truth of things when we're caught up in a standpoint, when we're caught up in a role, when we've taken a position. Earlier this year, when I was teaching the retreat in Bodh Gaya, there was a woman called Rachel who came to the retreat. And she lived and worked in Bhutan. Bhutan is a kingdom to the north of India. Some of you may even have been there. And she told me a wonderful story about what it's like to travel there. And she said, it's incredibly remote, and until recently, there wasn't actually a road out of Bhutan. And the Indian government helped build a road to connect Bhutan with India. And the road goes along a sheer cliff face and is actually blasted out of a rock wall. And there's a part of the road that's 10 kilometers long where there's so many rock falls that 2,000 people are permanently employed to clear the road so that cars can get through. So it's a very rocky, stony road with a sheer drop over the edge. And Rachel said she and two friends were with the driver driving in a car. She said they reached a point where there was a rock fall on the road and they stopped. And she said then the road behind fell away. The entire road just fell into the valley. So there they were. The road ahead was blocked and the road behind had fallen away. So there was no going back. So it was a huge, enormous avalanche. Isn't that how we feel sometimes on the Dharma path? That the road behind us has fallen away, that there's no going back. Yet we can't see the way through, we can't see the way forward. Sometimes the road ahead seems impassable. So Rachel said, I was so curious about what had happened and how she felt. She said she couldn't go forwards and she couldn't go back. And she said, it was the most terrifying experience of my life, but I also could not stay stuck in my fear. So I said, what did you do? And she said, this is what she said. She said and did this. She said, with bare hands, we picked up each rock and threw it into the abyss. One by one by one. So sometimes our practice feels like this, and we meet an obstacle. We meet a rock. So my question to you is, what are the rocks that seem to block your path, that seem to be obstacles to awakening, that seem to be barriers to the recognition and the realization of truth? It might be in your life that something has happened, there's been a relationship breakdown. Or it might be that your mother or your father are ill or have died. It might be, as I said last night, a child has died. So there's no going back. We can't undo those things. And we need to find a way forward. Yet before us on the road, there's the perceived obstacles. So the rocks in our life are our compulsions. They're our compulsions to acquire, to want, to need, to accumulate. Perhaps the rock in your life is your relationship to money. not enough, too much, what to do, how to earn it, and so on. The rock in your life or the barrier to freedom may be a desire to accumulate knowledge, to sit in that position of, well, I know so much. The rock might be the rock of a wound from the past. So there are many things that seem to stand in our way, that seem to block the way forward. The rocks we encounter might be our expectations of ourselves or our projections onto others. Or the rock might be our anger. Someone asked the Buddha, having killed what do you sleep with ease? Having killed what do you not grieve? Of the slaying of what one thing does Gautama approve? And the Buddha says, having killed anger, you sleep in ease. Having killed anger, you do not grieve. Another of the great rocks on the road that I hear about very often as a Dharma teacher and also in my work as a psychologist, is the difficulty of dealing with fear. So to have an awakened response to our fear requires us to investigate it, to see into it, to see how we construct our fear and maintain it. The teachings of the Buddha point to the end of all suffering, the end of anguish, the end of fear, and to complete fearlessness. And when we see the end of fear, it reveals our freedom. Or, to do it the other way around, when we really face our freedom, it's the end of fear. Our fear ceases too. The fear, of course, is dependent upon a separate sense of self. It can't exist without that. So to see the emptiness of self, to see that the self is empty of any inherent self-existence, is really to begin to discover the end of all fear. And we really need to cling to nothing, to cling nowhere, not even to our habitual patterns of being fearful. So the bodily responses that we have that are associated with fear aren't actually the fear itself. It becomes fear through the interpretation of the sensations, the story we add to it, how we perceive and elaborate and embellish through our memory from past experience, and then project into the future. So our fears build into an emotion based on our memory, based on our imagination often. And there's a really useful inquiry question you might like to ask if fear is an issue for you. And it's if fear is in the foreground, what's actually in the background? Perhaps it's disappointment or inadequacy. Or a fear that, well, I might not wake up. Other people might, but it can't happen to me. There might be a storyline going where we have a conclusion already about ourselves that holds and keeps the fear in place. So our fearlessness is actually to be realized. There was a wonderful inquiry a year or so ago in Australia where a woman came up to ask a question, and she'd suffered from breast cancer and had both of her breasts removed surgically. And her question, bless her for having the courage to ask it, was, can I have a relationship without my breasts? And then she spoke more about how in her body she had a pain in her foot. And her fear was that the pain in her foot was the cancer returning. And that even though she'd survived for quite a long time since her initial diagnosis, that the cancer would return. And as she sat there, I asked her what gave her the strength to face her situation. What was it that gave her the strength to overcome her fear about what may happen? And she said, you know, actually, it's actually coming to that which is not bound to birth and death. Coming to the knowing of that truth which is not bound to birth and death. So this is the unborn supreme security the Buddha was speaking of. And then it's our fear that dies. Our doubt that dies, our terror that dies. And so I said to her, you actually are having a relationship right now with all of us. And it was so touching. She wept and she realized that her condition and her situation did not prevent her from having an exquisite and beautiful relationship, connection, the touching of another's heart. So when we really directly see the truth of our experience, when in the seen, there's just the seen. In the heard, there's just the heard. In the known, there's just the known. Then every sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thought can be the touch of truth. Can be the freedom itself, the freedom we're looking for. The liberation isn't in some other realm somewhere. We can't claim truth as ours. We can't make it mine. But we can know it by seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching it. And we know it when light arises, vision arises, knowing arises, understanding arises, and our life is freed up. When we really see the truth of the situation we're in, of how things have come to be, it's the end of all fear. Fear ceases. And to end with another verse from a sutta. The Buddha says, there is this beyond aging, this beyond death. This the unaging, undying state. This free from grieving. From all animosity. Unobstructed, unhindered. Free from all fear, not burning. I'll read it again. There is this beyond aging, this beyond death. This the unaging, undying state. Free from all grieving, from all animosity. Unobstructed, unhindered. Free from all fear, not burning. And then at the end of the wonderful Metta Sutta, he says, above, below and all around, unobstructed, without hostility or hate, whether standing, walking, sitting or lying down, as long as one is alert, one should be resolved on mindfulness. This is called a sublime abiding here and now. So when we realize the sublime abiding here and now, we're touched by truth. Our fears subside. We no longer cling to a standpoint. And the expression of that understanding is love. The immeasurable expression of love. So may all beings live with unreactive awareness. May all beings realize a sublime abiding here and now. And may all beings be touched by truth that ends all fear. Thank you, each of you, for listening.